episode of Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a rebroadcast of an interview with Illinois mental health advocate A.J. French. But first, disability news for the week of June 17, 2019. Nearly a dozen parents and others told the Columbia, Missouri Board of Education last week that they favor changing the board policy to allow parents to record the meetings in which their child's special education or disability plan is decided. The board is expected to make a decision on the issue at its September meeting. As he introduced the recording policy, Superintendent Peter Stipelman said there were 10 states in which the law allows recording of the special education meetings, including Kansas. He could find no school district in Missouri with a policy that allows recording of the meetings. He said parents filed a lawsuit against the school district there seeking permission to record the special education meetings, but the court ruled in the school district's favor. Missouri is a one-party consent state, meaning only one party in a conversation needs to consent to a recording. Parents who spoke said the meetings are overwhelming, that it's difficult to take notes when the meetings are happening, and that they sometimes miss important details. Robin Schelt, president of Missouri Disability Empowerment, also said parents can record the meetings regardless of the board's policy. Kathleen Bossi said she has been through 9 special education meetings with her daughter. About a year ago, when her daughter was reevaluated, she said she couldn't remember what was discussed when questioned later by her husband. She says, quote, "There was so much to process, I couldn't get it all," unquote. Parent Amy Van Moreland said she has been through 7 special education meetings with her son, with a 5.5-hour meeting when he transitioned to middle school. She said it was wrong of any teacher to assume parents had malicious intent just because they wanted the meeting recorded. Members of the school board said they appreciated the insights of the parents, but they were careful not to commit to the parents' position. Disability advocates are pushing for a requirement that all medical schools specifically train future doctors to treat people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, but they're finding resistance. 2 proposals would establish a mandate as part of the standard curriculum that medical schools adhere to, were refused earlier this year by the Liaison Committee on Medical Education, or LCME, a group jointly sponsored by the Association of American Medical Colleges and the American Medical Association that accredits medical schools in the U.S. and Canada. The committee, which is responsible for setting minimum curriculum standards, is set to discuss a revised version of one of the recommendations sought by the National Council on Disability, or NCD, at a meeting later this month. Amged Solomon, attorney advisor for NCD, said research has shown that large numbers of doctors have never received training in caring for such patients, and many said they would benefit. Solomon said, quote, "Some providers incorrectly assume that people with disabilities don't have a good quality of life, or people with intellectual and developmental disabilities don't experience pain. We think the recommendation we're making could help rectify that," end quote. The council has called for instructing students in, quote, "basic principles of disability competent health care," end quote. Medical students would be required to demonstrate proper clinical practice skills and sensitivity, including respectful nomenclature, supported decision-making, and knowledge of living arrangements that might affect compliance, according to letters sent by the National Council on Disability to the committee. The Accreditation Committee first reviewed the NCD recommendation in February, along with a request spearheaded by the Association of University Centers on Disability, or AUCD, to include developmental disabilities in undergraduate medical education. Advocates and physicians say they have been successful in helping medical schools develop and incorporate training on a voluntary basis, though the goal remains to see every graduating doctor prepared to treat patients with intellectual and developmental disabilities. In one effort, 11 schools, including Harvard, the University of Louisville, and Georgetown, are participating so far. Physicians said even a small amount of training over 4 years of medical school could be instrumental in helping future doctors treat and communicate with patients who have disabilities. Dr. Matthew Holder founded the National Curriculum Initiative in Developmental Medicine, which is partnering with the 11 medical schools. Said Holder, quote, "What we would hope to see is a long-term improvement in not only the ability of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities to access care, but an improvement in the quality of care. We know, for example, that by changing attitudes and at least having a willingness to see this population and not be intimidated, you won't turn people away or you won't make it uncomfortable for them in your office so they go away," end quote. And finally, a mainstream department store is introducing sensory-friendly and adaptive clothing for kids, becoming the latest retailer to offer up apparel designed to meet the needs of people with various disabilities. Kohl's department store said this month that it's rolling out a range of adaptive clothing options as part of its three largest house brands for children. In doing so, Kohl's joins a handful of retailers, including Target and Zappos, that have launched clothing lines aimed at kids with special needs in recent years. Pieces that are part of the new lineup include features like flat seams, wider neck and hemlines, longer lengths, abdominal access, two-way zippers, reinforced belt loops, and hook and loop closures. The collection also includes clothing that is diaper-friendly and wheelchair-friendly, the company said. Items are designed to be easy for the user or caregiver to take on and off while mirroring styles in the retail's regular lineup. Said Kara Smoltik, associate product manager, quote, "Just because we are creating clothing for unique needs doesn't mean that it needs to be basic. We have made every effort to ensure that the product looks as close to our core line as possible. Everything from graphic artwork to pocket detail is reflective of the brand," end quote. According to the company, adaptive apparel is available for babies through juniors and young men's sizes on their website. And that's the news for this week.
Shop till you drop, ooh, ooh, ooh. Shop till you drop, ooh, ooh. Shop till you drop, ooh, ooh, ooh. Shop till you drop, ooh, ooh. Some people need a pill to feel okay. I feel good when they see a sunny day. Yeah, but let me tell you some real news. What's gonna banish the blues? Shop till you drop.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat, and I'm Vicki Nicewander. I'm joined today on the phone by my guest, AJ French. Welcome to the show, AJ.
Oh, thank you, Vicki. I'm so glad to be on today.
We actually have had AJ booked for several months. I really wanted to squeeze her into the program, and fortunately, today was the day that she was able to do it. AJ, as I said at the beginning of the show, is an advocate for mental health recovery and is here to tell her story and to share some of the things that she has done and maybe other people have done to recover from mental health issues. So welcome to the program again. And if you could, AJ, just kind of tell the listeners a little bit about yourself to start.
Sure. Well, I'm from the St. Louis area, and I am a mental health trainer and a speaker. The majority of my work is here in Illinois, but I do travel to other states. speaking at national conferences and also just delivering keynote addresses or specific training sessions for folks. I like to write, so periodically I write a mental health commentary for the Telegraph newspaper, and I just post blogs on Facebook and DaveWiseMatters.com and a few other locations.
That sounds great. So can you share a little bit about your personal experience with mental health issues?
Sure. So I'm a person who I live with a mental health condition, and I've had mental health challenges throughout my life, but it really, my life became unmanageable at about age 30. And at that time, I started, I just felt like a person who was living in a concentration camp. I was alive on the outside, but there was something inside of me that was just dead. And I experienced homelessness. I was told I would never work again due to a psychiatric disability.
Yikes.
And I'm not really sure what was worse, like hearing that awful, ugly lie, and that's what it was a lie, or believing it. I had a lot of psychiatric hospitalizations, but I think the biggest thing was just not having any hope and just feeling like I would never have any kind of future whatsoever. And there were some things that were real game changers for me in terms of my expectation. In fact, the Illinois Division of Mental Health has a mission statement that the expectation is recovery. That means the public health system expects that people who go in their system will actually recover, ideally not be trapped in that system for years and sometimes, unfortunately, decades. And for me, the game changer was about a decade ago. I walked into a training room in 2005, and I was surrounded by the most intelligent, articulate, passionate, compassionate people I'd ever met in my entire life. And these people were all just like me. They all had some kind of mental health challenge or, you know, real serious trauma experiences. About 90% of people who go through the public mental health system also experience trauma. So it's kind of a which came first, the chicken or the egg. Was it the illness or was it the trauma that then perpetuated mental health challenges? But these people were just so incredible, and I began to think, wow, if they can have this kind of a life, maybe, just maybe, you know, I could have some kind of good life. And that's when I get my hope back. And I've heard it said that if you ever lose your hope, you'll remember the moment that you got it back. And for me, it was in the summer of 2005.
Wow, that's a pretty powerful story. So do people, in your opinion, get stuck in that mental health system? Is that what happens, or is it make it more difficult to recover when you do that?
Yeah, sure. So like historically, we know that people have been institutionalized and they are stuck in institutions. And even with the Olmstead decision and people supposedly getting out of institutions, I mean, Illinois still has 7 state psychiatric facilities, and that doesn't include the developmental centers, or it doesn't include, when I say psychiatric facilities, I mean specifically state-operated hospitals.
Right.
And that doesn't include the developmental centers. It doesn't include even the, when people are incarcerated. That's a whole other kind of institution where people end up because of systems failures, because when institutions close, money doesn't always get funneled back into community support to make independent living, you know, what it can be. Especially in Illinois right now, where we had Lutheran Social Services of Illinois, they closed their doors. That was like the largest social service organization in the entire state. And part of their service array was mental health and addiction recovery services. So, when we have a governor who has a plan to reduce recidivism, which is, I applaud that. I mean, that's fantastic. I wish that all governors have that desire to reduce recidivism and to minimize the time that people spent in jail and prison. But when we have elected officials both in the executive and the legislative branch that will not come to an agreement on a budget, mm-hmm. then we have something like a major social service agency closing, and that, you know, instead of maximizing opportunity for people to recover and from people who are on disability income to transition to earned income instead of maximizing all of the potential we have. And there are some great resources. I hope you'll ask me about those resources in a moment.
Absolutely.
But instead of maximizing the potential that we have, what we're doing is we're risking people's lives. We're not just not living up to our potential, but we're actually putting people at risk.
You know, you talk about the seven institutions that are state-run for people with mental health issues. So, you know, I come mainly from the world of developmental disabilities, and we talk all the time about the seven state-run institutions for people with developmental disabilities, but I would imagine the impact really is the same. The bulk of the money that goes to support people living in that institution is then not available for those who are trying to make a go of it in the community. And I don't know if you know the average cost of a person living for the state of a person living in a state-run mental hospital, but for people with developmental disabilities, it's right around an average of $250,000 a year per person. And that seems like an incredible amount of money that could be used to help support somebody to live in the community.
That's an astronomical number. And I don't know the specific stat. I don't have it, like I can't quote it to you.
I'll bet it's not far off of that.
Institutionalization costs four times as much. Like if a person's in a nursing home, That's about four times the cost that it would be for that individual to live in the community with supportive services. I would like to see, I don't know where in terms of, there were two state hospitals that closed. The number used to be nine, it actually used to be greater than that, but there were two state hospitals that closed within the last 5 years, and one was in Chicago, Tinley Park, mm-hmm. and the other one was in Region 2, Singer Mental Health Center. And when these two hospitals closed, I would like to see, like, where does that money go? And even, where is the, are these buildings being put up for sale, and where is that money going back into the community?
Yeah, I think I heard last week that it just goes right back into the state budget. The Tinley Park site is for sale right now. It's on the market, and we were told that money, once the sale is made, goes back into the general fund, which is really pathetic in my mind.
Well, it's hard to track. So, like, you really don't know if it goes back into the general fund. It's hard to track, like, where does it go after that?
Yeah, who knows? That's just thrown in, and of course the governor and the legislature, I mean the whole bunch of them, really have done very little to fund services over the past year while this budget has been kind of in limbo.
No, we have services that are getting cut. It's not even funding, it's not even like maintaining funding, but we have like Lutheran Social Services closed. I know Impact Center for Independent Living, which is located in the area that I live in, they closed their doors on Fridays. Now they went to a four-day week instead of a five-day week. And, boy, I thought that was such an equitable solution. Like, all the employees took a little bit of a hit, so that way, nobody had to get laid off. Who can take, a full day of their budget being cut, of their salary?
Oh, right. And there are so many projects and programs in the state that are going out of business or are out of business as a result of this. And so how does that impact, I know you are very active in the world of advocacy for people with mental health concerns. So, what is the word from that end of the world as far as, what should we be advocating for regarding mental health?
Sure. Well, in terms of what works, what programs are effective, like what actually helps people get better, the first thing is the Certified Recovery Support Specialist credential. It's not a program. It's actually a human service professional credential it's for individuals that their primary professional identification is peer-delivered services. So when I think about what helped me get better and what helps a lot of people recover from life challenges, it's actually meeting somebody that has gone there before and has overcome and you know, like being able to see the light at the end of the tunnel. And RSS professional can work in primarily right now. The mental health field is the arena that a CRFS might be employed in, but they can be employed in the housing system. They can be employed in justice systems, in places that offer employment opportunities for folks. Really, pretty much any area where there are people and a percentage of that population would have mental health challenges. So it could that credential, it's kind of like this. It's kind of like we have this super Cadillac of credentials, and there are other states that have similar certifications and credentials, and maybe their state has, you know, 8 weeks or 10 weeks of training. In our state, a person has to go through not just education hours and passing a test, but it's actually a competency-based credential. So if you think about what does competency-based mean? Well, when you go to the driver's license and you pass, you take your course, you study for your written exam, and you pass the test, that's curriculum. That means that you've been able to repeat the information, but it doesn't actually prove that you're able to operate a vehicle. So how do you learn to operate the vehicle? You go through, you know, you have your driver's education course, and you have, like, your practice on the job, so to speak. And with CRSS, an individual would have supervised work hours as they're accumulating their education hours. And there, yes, there is still a test, but it takes a full year to learn. So in Illinois, we are among the strongest in terms of the requirements throughout the entire nation. Like, we've got the Cadillac of credentials, and we're keeping it parked on the mental health block. So I would say definitely expand this credential into other systems that serve populations of people with mental health conditions. The other things are, you know, they're evidence-based programs like WRAP, the Wellness Recovery Action Plan. And I always like to tell people that I am the evidence. I mean, you just say, well, it's a mental health education curriculum, and maybe people might turn off, but maybe they would turn their ears on when they realize how many people throughout the entire state and throughout the entire world have benefited from this curriculum. It has been proven effective in reducing the amount of medication that people use and are still able to live healthy. You know, for me, when I started using the WRAP program, my psychiatric hospitalizations decreased substantially. So, you know, like, I hate to put it in dollars and cents, but this is something that actually, you know, funding that, the expansion of that, would be financially in the best interest of the state.
Oh, of course.
And probably one other curriculum to WAM, the Whole Health Action Management. And that's really nice because it has a, this curriculum is, it's a curriculum that was an integrated from SAMHSA and HRSA. And SAMHSA is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration with the federal government. HRSA, I don't know what the acronym is, but it's like the counterpart on physical health.
Mm-hmm.
And they created this curriculum, and it's based on principles of self-direction, and it, like, you review 10 areas of health, and you being the person who's participating in the WAM class, determine which area of health that you would like to improve, and you set a goal, and then you keep coming back for several weeks, and there's both encouragement and accountability in that curriculum. And that's, we have, the Illinois has a statewide WRAP initiative that's always the demand is larger than the supply, but there is an established WRAP workforce, if you will. There's enough trained facilitators. Enough is not the right word. There's an established amount of trained facilitators mm-hmm. in the state, but we have far fewer WAM facilitators, only because it's a newer curriculum. It's only been developed in the last few years.
And this question will lead to the resources, but so if there are people listening today who maybe have self-identified as a person who has mental health challenges, or they have a child with mental health challenges, what is the path that you would direct them to get the help they need?
Sure. Like, number one and number two, the first place that I would suggest is to contact the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative, the administrative service organization contracted by the Division of Mental Health, and just Google Illinois Mental Health Collaborative, and there will be a phone number, there'll be a website, and look on the left-hand side of the website, and there'll be a phone number for the warm line. And what the warm line is, it's not like a hotline, like a crisis line. It's a warm line. It's for people that need support, that need resources. So if you you need to know, hey, where can I look? These the folks at the warm line are, it's really an excellent place to turn. They operate during business hours only, so they're not open on weekends or holidays or in the evening. And they're trained by not just the staff that actually answers the calls are CRSS staff, so it's people in recovery. And also, I always get the acronym mixed up. I'm going to try and get it right. I think it's CFPP, Certified Family Partnership Professional, I think. I'm not sure that I got that right. But basically, it's a comparable human service credential for family members. If you have, like, a child or an adolescent struggling with a mental health challenge, then the parents can earn this family partnership credential, and they can provide peer support to other family members.
AJ French, mental health recovery specialist. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email me at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week.
No, I stand my ground. Won't be turned around. Dragging me down, gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down.
And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Coming up next is Rootstock Radio. But before we get to that, let's give you what's playing at the Art Theater this week. Screening daily is Nonfiction. The film concerns a man in his 40s who runs a famous publishing house that publishes novels by his friend, a bohemian writer. The friends, along with their partners, try to navigate the new realities of their relationships when the publisher turns down his friend's new manuscript. Also screening daily is Too Late to Die Young. The movie is set in 1990 during Chile's transition to democracy. That seems a world away for 16-year-old Sofia, who lives off the grid in an enclave of artists and bohemians. The storyline takes place during the hot days between Christmas and New Year's Day, when the troubling realities of the adult world begin to intrude on Sofia's life. Too Late to Die Young is a portrait of youth and a country on the cusp of change. Before Nightfall, screening on Wednesday evening, is a richly imagined journey into the life and writings of Cuban author Ronaldo Arenas. The film spans Arenas's life from his rural childhood and his embrace of the revolution to the persecution he would experience as a writer and homosexual in Castro's Cuba, including his exile and death in the United States. For all up-to-date screening dates and times, consult the website at the Art Theater.org. And now here is today's episode of Rootstock Radio.
Welcome to Rootstock Radio. Join us as host Teresa Marquez talks to leaders from the good food movement about food, farming, and our global future. Rootstock Radio, propagating a healthy planet. Now, here's host Teresa Marquez.
Hello, and welcome to Rootstock Radio. I'm Teresa Marquez, and I'm here today with John Fagan, who is the CEO at Health Research Institute Laboratories in Iowa, and he's the executive director at the Earth Open Source Institute.